Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast. KSJE is supported by San Juan Regional Medical Center, whose vision is to deliver world-class care, making life better for the communities they are privileged to serve. Offering a comprehensive range of inpatient, outpatient, and emergency care services so residents can live life better here. San Juan Regional Medical Center, community-owned and operated, here for you. Back in Studio A with my guest this morning. We are spanning the state this morning with my guest, of course. Paul Reed is here joining us remotely from his home in the Taos area. Paul, good morning. Happy New Year. Nice to see you.
Good morning, Scott. So glad to be back on with you, and happy 2024 to you and everyone.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And joining us from the Las Cruces area, Dr. David Rochelle is here. He is a geoarchaeology consultant in the state. Good morning, Dr. Rochelle. Good to see you.
Yes, good morning.
Thank you for being with us. And I'm always excited when the technology works as well. And so it's great that you can both be with us from all corners of New Mexico this morning. Let me start with Paul Reed to kind of get us back up to speed on what our topic is today. And Paul, I know you and I have talked about this on multiple occasions, but it's this really fascinating discovery at White Sands in southern New Mexico. And kind of pick up the story from there, if you would.
Right. Sure, Scott. Well, these are footprints that were laid down, you know, many thousands of years ago by, it looks like, a family group and over a period of time. So we're not talking necessarily about a singular event, but folks walking in a lake deposit area where the prints were, you know, through the different geoarchaeology and geomorphological processes, these prints were preserved, then they were covered, and then were subsequently discovered during some archaeological and geoarchaeological work. And, you know, so that's exciting in and of itself. But of course, when these were dated, they were found initially at least to be between 21,000 and about 23,000 years old, which would push back our timeline in really in New Mexico and North America by many thousands of years. So that's particularly interesting, and we revisited this. We did this just in November with some additional dating that was done on this particular plant known as Rupia, which is a water-based plant. What's really interesting, and that's and why we have Dr. David Rochelle on today, is that David and his colleagues have been revisiting this issue, and they have some very interesting findings that I think are going to change this in some way.
Okay. Very good. Thank you for teeing that up for us so well. And that sounds like a great segue to you, Dr. Rochelle, about your findings and some of what you have learned about this site in southern New Mexico. What can you tell us?
Well, first off, Rupia, you know, that's the biggest complaint that most of the academicians have about the site is that the chronology is based on Rupia serosa, which is a submerged aquatic plant. It lives underwater. And it can't pull in carbon from the atmosphere like a terrestrial plant. So what it does is it pulls in dissolved carbon from the water. And that dissolved carbon in the water is from limestone. And it takes that old dissolved limestone carbonate material and it gets incorporated into the plant's tissue. When you date it, it'll come back older than what it really is. We've dated modern Rupia growing in the basin, and you would get a date of 8,800 years for a modern plant. So it is extremely unreliable and not very trustworthy. And this is something that's been around and known since the inception of radiocarbon dating. It is highly variable, though. Yeah, we got a date of 8,800, but if you kind of bop around the landscape and these drainages and you date different plants at different, you date Rupia in different locations, you know, you can get a range of 2,000 years all the way up to 8,800 years, and that variation is just caused by the environmental setting, like how close the plant is to a discharging spring, so on and so forth. But it's highly, it comes back thousands of years older than what it's supposed to be, and it's highly variable, and that makes it extremely unreliable.
Interesting. And so, but you're not saying that all carbon dating is not as accurate as we've been led to believe, but specific types of carbon dating, is that the idea?
Aquatic stuff is always tricky because it's pulling in old carbon from the water, particularly submerged plants. If you're dating trees, like a pine tree or something like that, it's far more reliable because it's pulling in carbon from the atmosphere, and that's not tainted.
And that's
Groundwater is tainted with old carbonate.
understood. And that's the idea with this site particularly, right? Because it's at a kind of an ancient lakeshore, seashore, and these plants then maybe were probably underwater, and that's where this dating data is coming from.
That's right. And they argue that the plant was growing in this really shallow, submerged setting that was really well aerated. And if that's true, then yeah, this hard water effect, this artificial aging that's really well documented for that species, would be negligible. But the problem is, what we found out in a paper we published last year in Geoarchaeology is that the plant didn't grow in shallow water. In fact, it washed in from other parts of the lake that have a substantial hard water effect. So the context of those seeds are not very good, right? And they are subject to a hard water effect. And it's thousands of years old, older than what it's supposed to be.
Right. Interesting. So, Paul Reed, what does that mean for our conventional wisdom of what we've been talking about all these months?
Well, it has pretty big implications for sure. Because, and Dave can certainly jump in on this, but I think his correction was somewhere in the 7,500 year range. So if we subtract that from a range of, say, 21 to 23,000 years ago, we end up 14 and a half ish to about 16 or 16 and a half ish. And as Dave recently pointed out in a talk that I attended in Albuquerque last year, this is still one of the earliest sites that we have in New Mexico. So, I don't think this is really about saying, oh, these footprints are super recent and we don't have to be interested or concerned about them. They're still very, very interesting. But because of the science involved in this, with this Urrutia plant, just providing really biased estimates of dating, we just have to be extremely careful about it. And, so what I hope this will spawn, from my perspective, is just a greater examination of this. And then sort of putting this site at, say, 14 to 16 or 16 and a half thousand years ago into the context of what we already know about the early Paleo-Indian period in New Mexico and in the West. And so I think it's going to contribute very important data there. So the fact that it isn't, 6 to 7,000 years earlier than anything else we've seen, this is how science works. We continue to date things, we go through this process, we evaluate data, and David is getting close to publishing a paper with his colleagues, I believe next week. So that will go out into the world and people will look at that and, the scientific debate will continue. But, as we've talked many, many times on the show, Scott, this is how we do archaeological work and scientific work. We
Sure.
want to continually look at things, test them, and kind of see what it looks like with new data.
Right. And so, as you're saying, this isn't really a big bombshell that changes our understanding of maybe humans in North America. It just kind of moves the date line back a little or up a little bit, if you will. Dr. Rochelle, again, with this research, does this maybe have some impacts for other sites in the world with some of this evidence that you are talking about and publishing that have been dated in this
Well,
way?
with this, I think it's remarkable. Even, I mean, it's remarkable regardless if it's 13 to 15,000 years old or 21 to 23,000 years old. It's still the oldest site in New Mexico, and it probably is a contender to be one of the oldest sites in North America. That's extremely significant. I think it's also with the age corrections, you have high consilience with the paleogenetic models, the physical archaeological record of North America. And it lines up with all of the geological data when the corridors opened up, we could get down, when we could have the ability to get down here. So all of that is extremely remarkable. It really is. Regardless, it is a tremendous scientific find.
Right. And as far as other sites in the world that maybe you have been dated using that other method that you have now brought forth some corrections to, could this be impacting other dates that we've been relying on in the past?
most people don't date Rupia because it's just too unreliable. This is one of the only sites that I know of where the whole chronology is based on that aquatic plant. Most scientists stay away from it because it's extremely unreliable. So this is kind of a unique situation. The reason why they used Rupia is because that's all that's there. You know, I mean, people have tried to find other things in that deposit and they just haven't had any success. So what is there? It's these Rupia seeds and they're interbedded and stratified in between the human footprints.
Got it. And that's really all that is at that site as you just described, right? Because of where it is and where it was these thousands of years ago at this lake shore, and there really wasn't a lot of other stuff happening or other remains, I guess, nearby, correct?
That's correct. You know, when you're working in these lake systems, that hard water effect kind of echoes through the ecosystem. And it's in everything, fish. It might be less, but it's still there. All the plants are offset by that. And it's tricky to get a really good chronology in a lake setting.
Right, understood.
Not easy.
Thank you. Paul Reed, this goes back, as Dr. Rochelle was mentioning, maybe puts this site now a bit more in the timeline, I guess, that we've been talking about, as these folks were walking down and corridors were becoming open into this part of North America. Does this help maybe make that timeline a bit more understandable, feasible?
Yeah, I mean, I think again in that 14 to 16 and a half BP, before the present range, it fits with what we know from other places. We still have a pretty small number of sites ultimately that would fit into this, just pre-Clovis and potentially 1,000 plus, 2,000 plus years pre-Clovis range. So, as archaeologists, we would like to find many more of these sites and to be able to understand what was going on. As we've talked a little, Scott, what happens with the Clovis horizon across North America and to the south as well is we have just hundreds of sites that come on fairly quickly, quickly again in an archaeological sense, decades, hundreds of years. And, so one of the things I've wondered about is, if we have this so-called Clovis expansion explosion of people, they're suddenly all over, what we describe as the New World in a relatively short period of time, we have to have pre-Clovis precursors. We have to have folks in the area before Clovis in order to have, that sort of rapid spread of people. So sites in this range are particularly important because they help us understand how that process unfolded. And if we're looking at routes and, through continental routes and, the ice-free corridor that's way up north, or folks are coming down the coast, there's been a real interesting paper that came out that's talking about, during this period of glaciation at the end of the Pleistocene, we've got a lot of sea ice that formed in the Bering Strait area and going south quite a ways. So the sea ice may have provided the corridor, the way to get across to, North America as we describe it today. The other thing to talk about for folks, of course, is it's very unlikely that people were intending to migrate to this new area. It's possible that with some advance party saying, hey, this is good, there's game, there's a lot of things going on, word got out and folks intentionally wanted to do that. But the way we think we understand the way hunters and gatherers do, their daily work of finding food, they're following game. They're looking at resources. If they're relying on seashore, lacustrine, any of those types of resources, they're looking to find those resources in areas, and then they may follow migrating animals. So we don't generally think of this as a directed type of migration event, but something that unfolded as people were basically living their lifestyles at that point.
Right, thank you. And Dr. Rochelle, again, from what Paul Reed was mentioning, finding other sites kind of from this era, there's not a lot maybe discovered so far, but are you hopeful that there'll be others that'll be discovered that'll kind of fit into this kind of newish timeline that we're talking about with this new research that you've been doing?
Oh, yeah, I think so. And we're definitely looking.
Right.
It's just a matter of time. So.
And talk to me a little bit about the uniqueness of this site. I mean, having it at White Sands, this area that's so geologically significant and so different from other places in the immediate area, in the state of New Mexico. I mean, it's a pretty to me, interesting place to visit, of course, and I imagine for both of you, an interesting place to work. And what is it about this area that makes this discovery so interesting? I guess just the way these footprints were preserved for thousands of years?
Oh, the preservation is unreal. I mean, you have this ideal depositional setting to where you can get footprints preserved with high detail. And I think what always is so I'm interested in, and something that makes the Tularosa Basin so unique, is that it's all gypsum sediment, and we don't really have a lot of localities where we have gypsum. New Mexico has a lot of gypsum, and the Tularosa Basin has a lot of gypsum, but very few places in the world like that. So we're working in this very unique landscape. The shoreline is extremely well preserved. It hasn't been destroyed by erosion. A lot of the archaeological record has been destroyed by erosion during the Holocene and historic erosion. But you still have these little shelves that have survived thousands of years that are still out there. And those footprints are one of those little nooks and crannies that's just been sitting out there for 10,000, 15,000, maybe 20,000 years.
That's amazing. Paul Reed, I mean, again, it's just such an amazing discovery. And the fact that it's still preserved so well, I mean, we're looking at the photo of, you can see the individual toes, for heaven's sakes, in these footprints.
Yeah.
Just remarkable. And you know, there's a wealth of information here that, you know, archaeologists, other researchers will continue to sort of delve into, you know, for the years and the decades to come. And that's what makes this particularly exciting. You know, the other thing to think about is, you know, as Dave was talking about preservation and just amazing nature of these, most of the archaeological sites or the sites that people have lived in for millennia across the planet, time and space, have not been preserved. Most have gone away because of different natural factors, some cultural factors sometimes. Older, you know, when there's older sites, sometimes newer groups move in, they make use of those resources, and then the sites go away. You know, the landscapes change, we have erosion, we have deposition. So, you know, it's a pretty low percentage, definitely less than 10%, I would guess, perhaps even 5, of the total number of sites that have ever been created in any particular region, you know, over whatever interval, 10, 15, 20,000 years, parts of the world, that actually survive to be studyable and available, you know, for folks to experience and do research on. So the fact that we have these footprints in this very special setting, you know, is absolutely phenomenal. You know, and so as we do the science and go through and try to understand the dates and all, none of that takes away from how amazing this finding is. And again, we essentially just want to understand as much about this as we can and have that work its way back into the models that we have for lifeways, how folks lived in this very important time period.
Right. Well, and as you mentioned, we don't have a lot of sites from this era. And so I guess any site that's found, you really want to learn as much as you can about it.
That's right. Each site in this time period is incredibly valuable.
Very interesting. Well, it's a fascinating topic. I know you and I have talked about it a number of times, Paul. Thank you for bringing Dr. Rochelle on to talk a little bit about this. But before we go, I did want to ask Dr. Rochelle a bit about the work that you do as a geoarchaeology consultant. And can you talk a bit more about that line of work and what it is that you do at sites like this and others throughout the region, throughout the state, throughout the world?
Just mostly in southern New Mexico. I just work as a consultant, and people hire me to, look at the stratigraphy, assess the context of the archaeological site and the artifacts, to establish a stratigraphic framework for the site. That's pretty much what I do. Sometimes I'll do paleontology work where they want to know the past environment of, say, like a baby mastodon that we found or something like that. But that's pretty much what I do. This footprint stuff has been very exciting, and I'm starting to get more gigs doing that, and there'll be more to come. This is a very exciting time, and it's really a paradigm shift in, I think, North America field archaeology. You know, these footprints, so I think we're going to see a lot more work.
Right. Very much so. And so your work involves a bit of working with the landscape, I guess, or interpreting the landscape too, in addition to these things that you find then on it?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I look at soil maps and geologic maps and then go out and we backhoe trench or use auger probes, so on and so forth. From there, you can kind of get an idea of the relative age of the landform. You can get an idea of where archaeological sites could be buried. You also get an idea of where archaeological sites, if they're there, they could be extremely disturbed. That's pretty much what I do.
Gotcha. Very, very interesting. Fascinating. Well, thank you for bringing your expertise to the program this morning. I really, really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
You bet. And Paul Reed, again, for your work, you work, I assume, with folks like Dr. Rochelle, in the sites that you go to and are working on in southern New Mexico and other places.
Right, exactly. I mean, Dave's specialty, the interface between archaeology and geology, and then geomorphology as well, which is the study of soils. This is really how we decode, archaeological sites by understanding how those different sediments have been laid down through time, and then basically putting those into a model for how whatever group we're talking about lived in that area. Because again, archaeological sites, people live in places, they have a life cycle, people migrate, they move on, the sites are no longer actively used, they go through cycles of change, some cultural, some natural. And in almost every case, unless we're in a very unique depositional environment, the sites get buried. So if we're going to go back and try and understand what happened there, we have to basically peel back those layers and understand how the dirt, the sediment, or in the case of the footprints, how the water laid sediments and the water itself influenced what we then see in that archaeological site. And we talk a lot in archaeology sort of broadly about the so-called Pompeii presence, right? Where you have a volcano erupt, it buries deposits, everything's nicely sealed. You see exactly how what people were doing at the time of, that in that case, a very catastrophic event. Well, most of what we study and most of the sites that do manage to survive do not have that kind of really clear, geologic layer,
Right.
excuse me, to cover it. So we have to do the hard work of understanding what happened after folks migrated, left their area, and then, other processes endured. So Dave's specialty is absolutely critical to the work that we do.
Right. Very interesting. And there's a great photo on the National Park Service website that I'm sharing, showing a bit, I think, about what you're describing, Paul Reed, about the different layers and Dr. Rochelle, the work that you do, I suppose, right? That you could find. Discoveries at a layer, and then underneath that could be even more that you would find from an older period of history.
Correct.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, gentlemen, I really appreciate you joining me this morning, both of you, to talk about this this find that really has put New Mexico, I think, on the map a bit more. And I know there's a lot of folks talking about it, and even with some of this new evidence and some new dating, it still is a significant find for our state. So thank you for talking about it with me this morning.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you very much. That's
Thank you.
Paul Reed and Dr. David Rochelle from my guest this morning here with me on KSJE talking about the White Sands footprints here this morning. Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.